Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them. Before we start the show this week, one of our past guests, you remember Cindy Liu, wanted to pass on her life skills as disability overtook her. She's now looking for space to store the tools of her life's work, and she's looking for help in finding it. If you think you can help, email us, dialogue@radio.fm, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, dialogue@radio.fm. Help us help Cindy Liu preserve some of the tools of her life's work, making historic costumes. In this week's Ontario News, razor blades found at school playground. Police in Hamilton are investigating after city workers found razor blades in a playground at a school for disabled children. Three university students working for the Parks Department discovered the blades this week, apparently taped on the underside of a climber, their supervisor said. How do we deal with this valuation of disabled children? Well, Barb Farlow is here on the show this week with Rob Wilson from the University of Alberta to give us their perspective. Disrespect welcomes Rob Wilson, who is a professor at the University of Alberta in philosophy, is it, Rob?
That's right, Jeff.
And a coordinator with the What Sorts of People Network in Alberta. And Barb Farlow, who was a mechanical engineer, is now an advocate on behalf of people with disabilities in Ontario. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for having us.
Okay. Barb, this concern that brought you together with Rob started with an incident in your life that the listener may not be aware of. Do you want to give us the once-over lightly?
Sure. I'll give you the brief version, Jeff. My daughter died in August of 2005 within 24 hours arrival at the hospital for sick children. Annie had a genetic condition that was related to disabilities. Generally, the condition comes with very serious anomalies that are considered lethal, such as severe brain defects. However, like all genetic conditions, there's a wide range that exists, and my daughter was mildly afflicted. We knew that we would have difficult decisions to make before she was born, and ironically, we had many meetings at the hospital specifically to discuss policies and eligibility for surgery and ethics and what would happen if this and what if that, because we really needed to understand the medical system so that we could properly manage our daughter's health within its confines. Once we were assured of the policies, her rights, the ethics, the matter in which any ethical disputes or dilemmas may be resolved, then we place our entire trust in the system and we felt completely confident that we would, together with the doctors in partnership, we would arrive at the best decision for Annie. When she died within 24 hours, at that point in time, we had been led to believe, because the intensive care doctor had described to us a surgery, that Annie would not likely survive. And we certainly didn't want her to suffer unnecessarily. And so we said no to that surgery. And she died. And I guess you might say it was a mother's instincts. Something just wouldn't let go. Something said that the logic didn't fit. When we arrived at the hospital, they said she had pneumonia and her trachea was fine. And then 24 hours later, she needed a severe operation on her trachea, and she didn't have pneumonia. And although I'm not a nurse or a doctor, there was just something lacking in the logic of that to me.
Yeah.
And so what we did was we acquired the records and had a friend who was a nurse practitioner start to review them, and that's when all the pieces started to it was like a domino. The first thing we discovered was that a do not resuscitate order had been entered long before we had provided consent, And that was, even then, that was a devastation to us. From there, we just tore the thing apart right from start to finish. What happened? What tests were ordered and so on. So ultimately, what we've come to discover is that two lethal doses of narcotics were withdrawn from the narcotic cabinet under my daughter's name, both without a physician's order.
Really?
And both are not shown as any being wasted or returned to the cabinet. The final medication report for the final nursing shift, which was 3.5 hours long, is inexplicably missing.
Oh.
Now, this is a direct entry electronic system. It's not a piece of paper that could fly onto the floor.
So
that was very concerning. And so the more we probed, the more concerns we have. So ultimately, after allowing everybody ample opportunity to explain what happened, to describe to us that our daughter's death was inevitable, we actually came to discover that the surgery that had been described to us had absolutely no diagnostic basis, and the physician said that it was a guess that she needed that.
And this was the surgery you refused.
Yes, that's right. And there were actually many things that could have been wrong, and some of them were actually very minor to treat. So we were very shocked, but because we had incredible faith in the hospital, we felt that it was appropriate to give them every opportunity to explain what happened and to collaborate with them with a resolution to improve communication and care for other children. I mean, ultimately, we knew that we couldn't have our daughter back. We didn't want to enter into any battle with anybody and be left bitter and angry for the rest of our life. And we felt that if we could put that aside and know that something had sincerely improved at the hospital, that that would be the best outcome for us in those situation, that situation, which was a difficult position to come to, but it was a rational one for us. After a year of working with the hospital, we could see that it was there were token measures. There was an apology. There was an internal review. But we could see that they weren't making the response that we wanted to see. So we went to the coroner, and the coroner did a review and determined that the care provided in the final 24 hours was not an appropriate form of care, and that that it was by no means certain that Annie needed distressful surgery or prolonged intubation. Unfortunately,
really?
The coroner refused to answer any questions. The coroner's office is not, they're not there to shame or blame or point fingers, but rather to provide recommendations to reduce the likelihood that somebody will die in a similar manner.
Why would they not answer questions?
Well, because it would have pointed a finger and, caused blame to be put on somebody's name.
So it seems that there's a second agenda at the coroner's office. Not only are they not to point blame, but they're not to reveal facts that might indicate blame.
Well, that's exactly right, yeah.
Okay.
Although it's true that part of their job is to provide at least certain kinds of facts, and part of what interests me in this case is that it appears, at least, that they haven't provided the facts that they are legally required to provide, which I find disturbing.
That's right. What Rob's talking about there is we discovered the last few months that we had a right under the Coroner's Act to they're called findings of fact that determine the cause of death.
Right.
And so if an autopsy had been done, which no autopsy or toxicology tests were done for our daughter, which is another little story unto itself, the findings of facts would be to include these reports. But as there was no such report for our daughter, the only finding of fact that her death was what they deemed a natural death was this report called the forensic audit that was carried out and supervised by the coroner, the coroner's office. And it was in the report by the Pediatric Death Review Committee that this report provided evidence that no active steps were taken to cause Annie's death. So recently we asked for a copy of this report that essentially exonerates the hospital from any suspicion of involuntary euthanasia.
How recently?
The first request was about 2.5 months ago.
All right.
And the response was that we should ask the hospital for that.
Right.
So we asked the hospital, and they said it was a privileged document, and they couldn't provide it.
Oh.
So we went back to the coroner and asked again and he would not provide it. So we continued to ask questions, and the most recent attempt, and probably the last one, had several people copied, including the media. And again, we asked for a copy of the forensic audit, to which we have a right. And we also asked one question. We said, was Annie given any fentanyl, which is an extremely strong narcotic, 80 times stronger than morphine, in the final 3.5 hours of her life? And the coroner said, this office cannot answer any further questions. There's nothing more we can do for
her. And fentanyl was the narcotic that was signed out in Annie's name?
Yes.
Oh.
Annie was never prescribed any fentanyl, and a lethal dose was withdrawn.
Yeah.
That's very significant because fentanyl is a very stable substance that can be, according to the experts who I spoke with, detected in a body that's exhumed many years later.
Oh, okay.
And that remains a possibility, a grim one, and certainly one that we don't want to undertake.
Yeah.
But it would seem that the truth could be revealed.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it sounds to me, doesn't it to you, Rob, as if she has a lot more than a human rights case. She's grabbed this by the smooth handle by making a human rights case out of it. And I guess expense mitigates against raising it other ways. Have you raised this with the police, Barb?
Well, you see, the trouble with the police department is the coroner's office is sort of the wall in between a patient with such a, or family member with such a complaint, and the police department.
Uh-huh.
So if the coroner says all is well, then you have a major, major wall to cross over.
Okay.
So what we have here is a coroner saying that all is well and yet refusing to provide the evidence that supposedly exists.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's two different sorts of things here that are easy to mix up. One is sort of what did happen.
Right.
And then the other is the story about what did or didn't happen.
Yeah.
And I'm, I think probably equally concerned myself about both of those. I'm concerned about the lack of transparency in the latter case of just, initially saying that there's going to be a lot of cooperation, a lot of sympathy, kind of soft apology for, whoops, lack of communication, whereas I think there was actually a lot more than a lack of communication.
Yeah.
That Sorry. I think just calls into doubt a lot of, the trust that you place in medical institutions and personnel, and raises, concerns about what is going on. Why don't people want to reveal the story? Why can't we find out what really happened? Because without that, we don't really know how to answer, the question of how serious the sort of apparent transgressions are in this case of either explicit laws or at least certain kinds of understandings between patients, trustees, and doctors and hospitals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
It's that inability to answer questions that is the first, I think, danger sign. And to this day, we don't know how or why our daughter died or why nobody tried to help her.
Yeah.
And what we've discovered, we had an expert review done on the medical records by a neonatologist in Ohio, and what he revealed was that our daughter's blood work became critical on the fifth day. Critical is pretty dangerous. It means that the lab has called the doctor and said, your patient's blood work is critical.
All right.
This happened continually. I think there were 8 or 9 tests over Annie's life, and a senior pulmonologist at SickKids also, we came to know, suggested non-invasive tests. They were concerned about a tracheal condition of some sort.
Oh, yeah.
And yet, we knew nothing about it.
All right.
We were certainly given to the understanding that Annie was being treated the same way as any child. And, in fact, the records are filled with comments such as, diagnosis later if symptoms persist.
Oh, yeah.
Well, when your symptoms are critical, there's really only one step further to go, and that's extremis. And that's exactly what happened in the final 24 hours.
Oh.
So it's very clear to us that there was a specific plan of withholding treatment all the way along.
Now we'll take a short musical break. The Maple Blues Review, live at Twisted Pines, John Mays. Shame on you.
Shame on everything you've done. Shame on you. You know that you were wrong. One of these days, you know you got to pay. Shame on you.
You got nobody but yourself left to blame. Ah, shame, shame, shame. Shame on you.
You've been listening to Disability Advocates, Barb Farlow and Rob Wilson, talk about the death of Barb's daughter at Sick Children's Hospital, what the implications are, and what the need for change is in medical treatment in Canada for disabled children.
The reason that we're particularly concerned, I think, is we felt that we had an excellent relationship with the staff.
Yeah.
We knew and trusted Annie's primary physician at SickKid. She was there for the first 6 weeks. We knew and trusted him very well.
Do you still think well of him, or
it's, you know,
everything's come into question now, eh?
You know something. Here's how I feel about it. I believe that you develop a culture and a system, and for one doctor to differ from that culture is very difficult.
That's
very
true.
Very difficult.
Yeah.
And especially if it's the surgeons that are saying we're not treating these kind of children, that makes all of the doctors who are, I guess, lower in the totem pole, really,
which is all of the doctors.
Yeah, there's really nothing they can do. So, some people say that I'm being very generous, but I like to think that this doctor that we knew and trusted so well was a victim to a certain degree as
okay.
well.
Yeah.
One of the things that happened in the final 24 hours that was really distressing was that Annie had shortly after arrival, she had a respiratory crash. And that's when, if you watch a show, one of those medical shows, people come running with crash carts and so on.
Okay.
It means that she was having trouble breathing.
Right.
In our case, we had one person come along. It was the respiratory therapist. And she started to beg Annie to, in order to keep her oxygenated. And our trusted doctor came in and took a blood test and left. And we just stood there. And we were torn between running out into the hallway and screaming for help.
Yeah.
Which was certainly a bizarre thought, because here we were at one of the best children's hospitals in the world, and this would be a totally irrational thing to do. And at the same time, we trusted our doctor completely. And so we stood there, and it is in the records that it was over an hour later before our primary doctor called the critical care unit. So this is what they call, and maybe you've heard it before, Jeff, they call this a slow code in the business. It means when somebody doesn't really want to help somebody and they go through the motions.
Oh.
And, you know, if...
So this is the doctor you initially grew to trust?
Yes.
Okay.
And my belief is that the critical care said, we're not taking your patient. And
okay.
He was stuck. That's my belief.
Yeah.
But if all of the work that we're doing, if all that it ever does is to prevent this from ever happening again, that a parent or a set of parents would stand there and watch their child slow-coded like that, that's a terrible, terrible thing to happen.
Well, SickKids has had these issues in the past, hasn't it, Rob? I mean, you remember the Susan Nellis case in the 80s, which eventually exonerated Susan Nellis, but I don't know they ever found the root of the problem, did they?
No, that one's quite a long time ago, but certainly more recently in your listeners' minds will be the case of Sam Sansalone, who was on your show a few weeks ago, I think, dealing with very much the same kinds of issues. I mean, every child's condition and position is unique, but there are certain eerily similar details that are shared across those the two cases, and I know that again that the one of those concerns the shift from complete trust, thinking, well, the doctors are on top of this, they're really looking at their best interest, to then wondering, hang on, what's going on here? You know, I think Sam told that story of the monitor. And again, it's this kind of implicit little thing that you might not notice, and then all of a sudden you have to turn around and go, hang on, there's something else going on here. And one thing is to start to think, well, there are evil people here who are doing evil things. And I tend to agree a little bit with Barb that that's probably not really what's happening. There are people who are part of a culture that operates in a certain sort of way, and I think one of my concerns is that we have a certain kind of complacency in society more generally, that everything's just going smoothly and this is one of the leading hospitals in the world, and these are people with, you know, high ethical standards and so on. And all that may be true, but it doesn't, if there's an underlying culture that effectively rations healthcare, that doesn't value infants and children with various disabilities or diagnosed conditions in the same way that they would value so-called normal children.
So you think that there is a rationing of care that may be going on here?
Well, I think that is very likely, whether it's part of an explicit policy or whether it's just an implicit part of the culture, I don't know. But one telling thing was when I started up this recent Facebook group, Justice for Annie, which is easy to find on Facebook and has a number of members now in the last week or so, focused on this case. I had a private response from a friend of mine who is on both sides of things, is a doctor, is a specialist, and has also had an experience of losing a child early on through her own consent of withdrawal of treatment, which she said was a very hard decision to make. But one thing that she said about this case, without knowing much about the details of the case, but one sort of reaction was that, you know, well, sometimes parents just have to kind of let go and move on. So she's obviously partly speaking about her own experiences. But the other telling comment was exactly a comment about the reality of there being limited resources and we can't always...
She said that.
You know, and I thought, well, that's an interesting thing to come out just... you know, between friends and but from somebody who's working on the medical side as well. So it's a little bit of anecdotal.
Well, I'd like to add to that idea of rationing or priority setting or distributive justice. It has various names. I attended a healthcare conference because I'm a member of a patient safety organization, so I do a lot of speaking and attending of these kinds of conferences. And this one was in Toronto, and there was a physician by the name of Charlotte Moore, a pediatrician who works 50% of the time at the Ministry of Health and 50% of the time at a sick kids hospital. And she was giving a talk specifically on priority setting. So, of course, I couldn't miss that one.
No.
So in her talk, she described the various inputs that are used to develop priority setting. And one of them, she said, was values. So I had to ask. I put my hand up at the end and I asked, whose values? And she said the values of the majority of the public.
And who sets those? Do you have a referendum every time this comes up?
You know, I believe that when it comes to infants born with disabilities, the values of the public are deemed to be the values, the majority values of people who choose to terminate those pregnancies beforehand.
Oh, okay.
That's my belief. I was very, very upset, and so I asked to speak to her afterwards, and we had a lengthy chat. And I asked her, what about human rights? What about the value of autonomy? And her response is, well, we can't do everything for everybody.
Really?
And see...
I think there is a conviction buried in that, that that'll never happen to her.
Yeah.
She'll never be brought in on a gurney from an automobile accident with iffy life signs. And so she doesn't have to worry about whether she'll be revived or not. But it ain't true. You know, we're all subject to the same forces.
And I thought it was of grave concern that she told me 50% of her job was at SickKids on the front line working on palliative care for complex care kids.
Oh.
So, you know, that I thought that that was certainly a conflict of interest.
Well, it happens not only to young people. I mean, I have to tell you that your perception of a culture, Rob and Barb, is probably not far from the truth. There was an article in the Globe and Mail on April 23rd where private care crusader Jacques Chahouli has been called to account for slow coding effectively a patient who walked in with emergency breathing problems, was told to sit and wait, and they waited till he practically fell out of his chair and his teeth fell out. His face was bluish purple, and then they examined him and they said, "Oh well, he's dead." And they, you know, when another woman in the emergency room with her daughter or son tried to revive him, the nurses said, "No, don't," you know. And you know, it's coming out into the open now, and it is quite disturbing.
See, nobody ever says no, you can't have treatment. They just say yes later. That's how it works.
Yeah.
And later never really comes. And if it does, it's too late by then.
Yeah.
You know, it may very well have been too late for my daughter in the final 24 hours. That we'll never know. But
yeah.
her respiratory status had degenerated so much through the weeks that we were unaware of. So it is a concern. My own feeling is I've done a lot of research into rationing and
right.
and so forth. And, you know, we like to argue that we don't need to ration. You know, that why are we wasting so much here and there, and can't we do a better job? And all of those things, I think, have merit. But on the other hand, rationing is occurring.
Yeah.
And so while we argue that it should never happen, it's happening.
Yeah.
So if we don't get there onto the table, people from disability right there at the policy table with a voice, then these things are just going to go on. And by the time we ever get involved, they may be very well developed. And it's going to be too difficult to change things. So my own feeling is to take the reality and get involved.
Yeah, it's a hard one to grab a handle by. But somebody, I think it was you, Barb, made a mention of surgeons, and I've done a year's worth of hospital planning, which doesn't make me any kind of an expert, but it made me very familiar with the concept that the surgeons call the shots and everybody else follows.
Right.
So maybe it's the place to direct these policy initiatives.
Yes.
One of the things that really has grabbed me about the Annie Farlow case, really are Barb's efforts, and so this is not to, put a total halo over Barb, although maybe one should, but it's to say that it's just staggering how much work somebody like Barb has to do just to get fundamental information, to raise awareness, to get somebody to, in some sense, really care, and the negative reactions that you get from those in positions of power, like in the hospital, when they start to feel threatened, when there are, the conversation is not going the way they intended.
Yeah.
Even though, in some sense, a parent and also a patient has certain kinds of rights to certain kinds of information, and,
mm-hmm.
and of course hospitals want to present themselves as always doing everything that they
possibly
could and abiding by every possible regulation, and there being nothing that's not being fully revealed, that they are operating transparently. But that just doesn't seem to have happened in this case, and that's why this case has been going on for over 3 years, I think, despite the huge efforts and huge investments that not just Barb, but her whole family have made in this case.
Now, I'm kind of surprised that it is still behind closed doors. I mean, if I can find it, surely the Ontario government's aware of it. Why have they not picked it up and run with it, you know?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing in a public health care system. The priority strategies are developed within the government and then implemented, of course, in a public hospital.
Yeah.
So it would seem to me shooting yourself in the foot to expose these things which the government itself has created.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're looking to be reelected, I don't know that you want to expose these things. It's a problem really with that public health care system that we don't really have an independent body. And in fact, public hospitals, there is no accountability anywhere. The ombudsman does not have jurisdiction over hospitals. And another thing...
Yeah, that's true, eh?
Yeah, and another thing regarding these children like my daughter or anybody that's vulnerable is that there really is no accountability. We have a small claims file going right now, and the hospital is trying to move it to Superior Court.
Oh, yeah, and you had a hearing this week, didn't you?
Yes, we did. We had a motion this past week. It was supposed to be a two-hour motion that went almost 6 hours with no decision made.
Well, what does that mean? It means the decision's still coming?
Yes. Well, you see, the automatic position that the judge and probably many people would take is that a small claims court just is not set up procedurally to handle a complex medical malpractice case.
Right.
And that the case has general importance because of the reputation of the hospital.
Right.
When a family has made allegations that their child's death maybe was caused by a lethal dose of narcotics and that there was a plan, and in fact the hospital has policies to withhold surgery for certain infants or withhold life-saving care. Those are extremely serious allegations. I'll be probably the first to say that, and certainly they aren't made loosely without much evidence either. And so the position, it seems, that the judge was taken initially was that, well, it's a no-starter. We can't do something like this with these doctors' reputation in small claims. But you see, the problem...
To him, it's like carrying it through in traffic court.
Yeah, but the problem is that to pursue this, according to many, many medical malpractice lawyers that I've spoken with, to pursue this kind of a case in Superior Court, if we won, so the best case scenario would mean that we would likely lose $200,000.
Right.
And if we lose, we'd lose $600,000.
So if you won, you would have to bear your own costs, and if you lost, you'd have to bear your own in the hospital's costs.
There would be a portion of your cost that would be covered, that's for sure, by the losing party. But the thing is that it's a very expensive endeavor for justice. So we're just not prepared to go there. And so we argue, on the other hand, that actually this case is not complex, except that the hospital wants to make it so.
Right.
It really is a basic consent case.
Oh.
And the DNR was entered without informed consent, and we have in writing the intensivist wrote after the summary of the meeting that a discussion with the father through the night suggested that the parents' wishes may be changing. There's a lot of conditional words in that.
Yeah.
And in fact, what happened was the intensivist through the night, when my husband was alone, said to my husband, "You must be very tired," and of course he was tired. And he said, "It's been very difficult for your family." "Yes, it's been very challenging." And he said, "If your daughter should make a turn for the worse, would you like her to suffer? Do you want her to suffer?" Well, you know, who's going to say yes to that?
That's right.
And so, as best we can tell, that was the sense that the intensivist had, that we were changing our mind to pursue treatment.
Oh, okay.
That's the best we can go on.
Yeah.
And so you see how these things are framed and reworded and taken in by the...
That's scary, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
It is, yeah. Another thing I wanted to say, Rob had mentioned about the supportive groups, and we very much appreciate that. But ironically, other support that we've received, sort of through somewhat different means, is by the system itself. The Canadian Pediatric Society, for instance, invited me to submit an essay about my daughter's life and death, and then they published it in their journal. The Ontario Hospital Association invited me to speak for their Patient-Centered Care Day, and the University of Toronto Joint Center for Bioethics invited me to give an endowed lecture on ethics and patient-centered care that is webcast. So the way I understand this, the way I've come to understand this support, is that I believe that those people on the inside, they know there's a problem. They recognize it. They're frustrated by the problem as well. Yet they may not be in a position to know how to fix it or to even speak up about the problem.
Right.
So I, you know, very much appreciate the support of these groups, and there are many others across the country where I've spoken, and I appreciate that. And that's why I suppose I try to take a collaborative attitude to this. That this isn't a witch hunt. This is, come on, let's all talk about these issues. Let's bring them out. Let's invite the disability groups, the policymakers, the medical staff. Let's talk about these issues and how can we resolve them. How can we deal with the financial issues at hand? Always treat people with compassion and humanely. Don't let any patient suffer unnecessarily, certainly as my daughter did in the absence of palliative care in the final week of her life. We have some difficult decisions to make, and pretending that those decisions don't even exist or don't
All right.
So nobody wants to be the first one to talk about it.
No, I can see that. And it's going to be difficult to make it an election issue, but less and less so as the baby boom reaches the age where health problems take them further and further into the orbit of the hospitals and of intensive care. Rob and Barb, was there anything else that you in particular thought we might have overlooked in our brief discussion of the ethical issues you've raised about hospital care for disabled children?
One thing that we didn't bring up that I'd just like to mention is the importance of consent.
Right.
And I've found that in my own situation, I think the attitude of many people is to look at my daughter's genetic condition, at the label itself, which is probably what the doctors did, which is very bleak, and to say, well...
What's the label?
It's called Trisomy 13.
Oh, yeah.
And it, without a doubt, the children, most of them die very soon after birth because of severe brain defects and
right.
heart defects.
Right.
But as your former guest, Sam Sansalone, has told his story, his daughter's now 7 and very happy. And,
yeah.
And sure, these children are limited. Sam's daughter walks independently, and she does very well. But they are very delayed, and it's a difficult decision, a very personal decision, as to caring for a child like this when you know that not providing treatment will allow for a natural death. And certainly not a decision that we made very lightly, but with much information and consultation with other families.
Yeah.
But so a lot of people look at the outcome and they say, well, you know, she probably would have died anyway. But that's not the issue here. And you know what? I would even say if everything transpired appropriately, because we didn't want our daughter to live on machines, we didn't want her to suffer unnecessarily, that perhaps the chance is greater than not that she wouldn't be alive. But that's not the issue. The issue is about consent. The issue is informed consent.
Yeah.
And this is what we're so worried about, is that they crossed a really serious line by just arrogantly stripping our rights in such a covert manner.
Yeah.
Without any reasoning, because we were very rational, we had a good relationship with the staff, it was
yeah.
clear, and it's in the records, that we didn't want to pursue futile care.
Yeah.
So this is the concern. And I compare that to...
So you played ball, and then they changed the rules behind
exactly,
your back.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. You know, it's like, I suppose, in the early days when they did the sterilization without consent, how many people would have said, well, look at that girl. What kind of a mother would she have made?
Right.
Come on.
Yeah.
But you see, again, that's not the issue. It's the consent. Consent
yeah.
is so important. And yet, we do recognize when, for the situation of sterilization, we really strongly recognize that need for consent. When the little girl, Ashley, out in Seattle, you remember the growth attenuation surgeries?
No.
The little girl had, she was severely delayed, mm-hmm. and her parents wanted a number of surgeries done to keep her small so she wouldn't grow up.
Oh, I do remember that.
Yeah, and one of the surgeries was a hysterectomy.
Yeah.
And the disability group there in Washington did a full review on the whole situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I might add that the surgeries and so forth were done with parental request and consent. But the disability group took great offense when they discovered and realized that the hysterectomy caused the sterilization.
Right.
And therefore, the law was broken.
Yeah.
So you know, you look at how we observe that and respect that law. And yet, I mean, here we are. The right to consent... for treatment or non-treatment is a really, really important issue in anybody's life. I mean, if a patient comes in after a terrible car accident and they're essentially brain dead, we still allow the family the right of consent. It's very important.
Yeah. yeah.
And my daughter was never on life support.
Oh, okay.
And what I guess I would add that we have touched on, but I would like to underscore, is the need for public awareness,
yep.
public dialogue, public involvement in particular cases and in the connections between various cases. It's
okay.
interesting that Barb mentioned the case that's become known as the Ashley X case, or just the Ashley case on growth attenuation
right.
Treatment, because that's another case that our group, the What Sorts Network, has taken an interest in, blogged on, and been in conversations with people involved in that case,
yeah.
As well in Sam's case as well. Also, in our group grew out of looking at the history of eugenic sterilization, particularly in Alberta, and trying to get broader access to sets of records about some things that are fairly distant in the past, but again, there's a reluctance to have that information made publicly available and to have, I think, a kind of cleansing public discussion about stuff that ended, at least explicitly, in 1972 in that case.
Yeah.
But again, to start to think about the common theme here is the need to not wash one's laundry in public, but to really think about what our values are as a society,
yeah,
and whether we live up to them.
Yeah.
Or whether there are cases in which we say one thing and we really are kind of content to implicitly fall off that path and do something else. And I think that's especially the case when it comes to issues around disability and impairment.
Right. And you know, when we talk about prenatal screening and testing and termination, people take great offense when we bring the word eugenics, or lately as it's called, the new eugenics, into that, because they say this is a informed consent decision made. It's a personal decision between a woman and her doctor, and it's nobody's business, and it's not appropriate to use that word. Yet when we have health policies and strategy, priority strategies that are based on the values of the majority,
which are unknowable and can be
yes,
appropriated by anybody.
Yes, and we are making treatment decisions and forming policies at the newborn stage. Then you know what we have is a transfer of these private decisions that represent a majority onto the minority. And in fact, when it comes as a government health policy, then in my definition, that does constitute the new eugenics.
Yeah.
So right now, of course, we have the genetic testing for certain, and it's not just genetic testing. It's actually they do a lot of ultrasound testing for anomalies like brain defects.
Okay.
And there's a large number of terminations for those reasons. But today we treat for, you know, or we do the screening and testing for a number of conditions, but we know that tomorrow's genetic testing is going to enable us to do even more testing.
Yeah.
So we really have to look at these trends and understand them and really, really make sure everything's transparent about what we're doing. And that's just absolutely not being done at all right now.
Maybe there needs to be some hoops, too.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you have transparency, but I mean, if you're still fighting for the coroner's records, the fact that you're entitled to them doesn't mean an awful lot. What you really need is a point where everything stops until certain conditions are made and then continues on. Everything stops except the patient's care.
Yeah.
You know? And, yeah, it doesn't sound to me as if we have those kinds of hoops for the system.
No.
Yeah.
It's very frustrating.
Yeah.
But well, it's true that people, you know, in positions of responsibility and power could make a big difference. If some politicians jumped up and down and said, you know, this case, something sort of smells fishy here. We really do need to get to the bottom of it. There do seem to be issues about rights here,
mm-hmm.
and that could make a difference.
Yes. Actually, just one more thing to mention. We were in Geneva, Switzerland 2 years ago. I was speaking at the World Alliance for Patient Safety, and it was arranged to meet with a human rights officer from the High Commissioner's office.
Oh, yeah.
And it was at that point in time, after I told the story, the human rights officer, I said to her, you know, it seems like where I live, everybody's like, well, whatever, you know, she had disabilities.
Yeah.
And the human rights officer, I'll never forget, her eyes widened, and she looked at me and she said, that's not the way the High Commissioner's office sees it.
Yeah.
And they asked to be followed on our case. So we copy them on various letters to the coroner and so on. And when we're finished, we'll give them a complete review, because they want to understand how these issues play out at the front line in a developed country like Canada.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that they'll be surprised.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it is interesting that if you go back to the Kaylee Vitelli story, which, as you'll remember, was the lead story on the national CBC's Peter Mansbridge,
yeah,
national, for three nights in a row,
yeah,
then that just dropped straight off, partly as some of the circumstances changed. And the real question is, well, why was there such intense interest in that, and why did that just disappear from public consciousness? Why was there no real follow-up there?
Perhaps because it was viewed as exceptional.
It could be, but one of the things that also shifted as that story unfolded was that the... And I was surprised this was never really reported, was that the condition, Joubert syndrome, is typically not a life-threatening syndrome.
Uh-huh.
And one might naturally think that as this child is still alive, although she was literally on the operating table, ready to have her heart removed to save the life of another child, that actually she's doing okay. She's, mm-hmm. she's still a child with a condition and with some problems, but it doesn't look like, it looks like there was a mistake made of some kind somewhere along the line.
The very kindest thing you could say would be an error of judgment.
Yeah, that would be kind.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, the facts are that 3 years previous, SickKids and Mount Sinai actually published an article specifically on Joubert syndrome.
Yeah.
And but it wasn't about treatment for children with Joubert syndrome. It was about ways to detect Joubert syndrome through MRI brain scans prenatally so that the option of termination exists. So sort of the question in the air there is, once we have a firm way of knowing or discovering these, identifying these conditions before birth, does that mean that treatment options are then restricted?
Yeah, it should be part and parcel of this debate on stem cell accessibility too, shouldn't it? I mean, they're the same issue, just different stages of life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't mean to compare them as the same, you know, the same values, but you know, it is the one same value that underlies them, is what is life? When are you entitled to the same efforts that would be made for you and me?
Uh-huh.
You know, yeah. Yeah, I'm not happy either with that, especially in Canada, when it comes out, as Sam Sansalone says, that in the States where you pay for your own care, this seems to be less prevalent.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so it does seem to be a function of a public health system.
Yes, you know, I've found because of through my work, I've gotten to know many Americans and American leaders in healthcare, wonderful people, and I detect there's a huge difference when I tell what happened to my daughter to an American in a private healthcare system
mm-hmm.
compared to a Canadian.
Mm-hmm.
The Americans are just shocked.
Mm-hmm.
shocked.
Mm-hmm.
Ironically, I sat beside a man on a plane several months ago, and we started chatting about healthcare. What else? That's what I talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out that he was not only a physician, but actually a very well-known pediatrician.
Oh.
And he was then retired, but he had done incredible things in his career. And so I asked him, what would you do if you had one ventilator and two children? How would you choose?
Yeah.
And he said, well, you don't choose. You get on the phone and you keep calling and calling until you find another ventilator.
Right.
And I said, oh. And then I said, okay, how about this? What if an administrator came up to you and said, we think it would be better to let that child die because, you know, the quality of life versus cost of treatment.
Yeah.
And really, the child's going to be a burden on the parents. So we're going to ask you not to pursue aggressive measures for that child.
Yeah.
What would you do? I asked him. And he looked at me and he said, no administrator is going to tell me how to be a doctor.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just realized, I really appreciated his perspective because I realize how different it is in Canada and who's really calling the shots. I don't believe that the doctors have the same autonomy, perhaps depending on their position and rank and so forth. But I think that the...
Well, autonomy is something you have to seize. That's true. And it may just not be a Canadian thing to seize autonomy. It certainly is an American thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
And for the Americans, consent is very, very strong, very strong, very much respected. One of the specialists that I spoke to about my daughter's care, we had a chat, and he asked me what happened, and I told him, and I said, I guess the doctors didn't want to save her life. And he paused, and he said, well, I don't know about that. He said, in my country, we might not always agree with somebody's decision, but we respect it. And, you know, the first time in my life...
What country was he from?
From the United States.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Just the way he said it, we might not agree, but we respect it.
Yeah.
And this is, of course, now I'm comparing private health care with our system. And that's, you know, that's not always the only comparison to be made, that's for sure.
Well, when we started it, there wasn't supposed to be any difference.
Yeah.
People who are concerned about this attitude that if you can't fix them, throw them out, which is, I think, common to most medicine, it affects anybody with a disability or anybody who's too old.
Uh-huh.
It's disturbing.
Uh-huh.
Where do you put your pen to paper? Where do you put your oar in if you're not directly involved? If you don't have an issue like Barb does, but you think that her issue is worth supporting?
Rob, are you going to answer that?
Well, I guess the place I was going to say, though, you said, you know, you were thinking about things more generally, was if you go to the Facebook group on the case, mm-hmm. Justice for Annie, if you just typed into search engine, you can find out more details about this case. It'll link up to the Annie Farlow website, and you'll see who else is involved. But independent of that, more generally, organizations like the Canadian Association for Community Living, based in Toronto, is an ally in issues like this. The organization Not Dead Yet, based in New York State, is another. Generally speaking, almost any large-scale disability-focused organization will have take a keen interest in these kinds of issues. The What Sorts Network is another kind of crossover venue between university researchers and community organizers, and we run a blog. If you just type in What Sorts into Google, you'll find us fairly readily, and you can search by category and by keyword. You can find things either on the Farlow case or many other things that are focused on disability there. I think working with those kinds of organizations is the way to go, but ultimately I think people, maybe many of your listeners are already informed about lots and lots of these cases. They don't need it, but you need to get details about a particular case like this and start to see some of the connections between different kinds of cases. These aren't purely isolated. You might think, oh, well, who really knows what happens in that case, and it was an unfortunate tragedy, an inevitable tragedy for this particular case, and maybe there were some oversights or so on. But number one, we don't really know. That's one of the issues. We don't know, and we're being pushed away from finding out what went on in this case. And number two, there is already enough evidence to suggest that there's a certain kind of systematicity in cases like this. There's not just one. There are a number of them that line up in certain ways. And that's kind of scary, I think.
Well, there's this case that's recently hit the papers, too, with Kaylee Vitelli and her husband, her father, I think it's Jason, and her mom, Crystal. And they've come right out in the open in the paper and said, we think Sick Children's Hospital is not a safe place for a daughter. We're having her moved to a hospital in Newmarket.
Yes,
and it's just that straightforward for them.
More recent kinds of cases, again. And again, I think it underlines the need to get more information, to find out more. There are strong allegations made in a number of cases. What do they point to? We don't know until we go further down the track of having this kind of, I think, semi-public or completely public dialogue. The idea that so much of this is going on behind closed doors, I mean, in a society like Canada's that prides itself on human rights and the equality of all people and so on, I just don't think this is acceptable.
On that note, we've pretty much run out of time. I'm glad that both of you have commented on this. I think we've given it a pretty thorough go over in the time that we have. Okay.
Great.
Thanks.
Good. Okay, well, thanks a lot. That's great. I look forward to hearing it.
Yeah, thank you for your interest in this, Jeff. It's an important subject.
All right, thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
You've been listening to disability advocates Barb Farlow and Rob Wilson talk about the death of Barb's daughter at Sick Children's Hospital, what the implications are, and what the need for change is in medical treatment in Canada for disabled children. To take us out, Mavis Staples, We'll Never Turn Back, The Cut, Turn Me Round. Freedom land. We'll email you, but you have to email us first. Dialogue@inbox.com. dialogue@inbox.com. You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.mcmaster.ca. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.